Hey, how's it going?
You know, I am doing great. I literally just bought the book that I want to read this summer while we are working our way through our annual Summer in the Psalms series. So I am super excited about that.
Yeah, what are you going to read? I remember, I think you've said it on the podcast, but remind me.
It's a book called The Structure and Theology of the Psalms by O. Palmer Robertson, a person about whom I know nothing, but I want this year to take some time to get to know the big picture of the Psalms, why they're compiled the way that they are, the way that they flow one into the other. So I am really curious, and this is one of like two books I could find about that. So I am really excited about it.
Absolutely. That sounds great. I can't wait to get the insights that you get from it.
Yeah, it's going to be wonderful. But so we're starting that soon, though not super soon. So I am really looking forward to that. But how about you? How are you doing?
I am doing good. You know, for our regular listeners who may be tracking my family's story, they may be asking, hey, are your kids back from India? How was the trip? Well, no, we're double recording while they're gone. And so they're still in India. So I don't have any updates there, but I, like you, am super excited for our Summer in the Psalms series. That is coming up in 5 short weeks. So if our audience would like to participate with us, our Summer in the Psalms reading schedule will be in the show notes of this episode and all future episodes up until Labor Day. So our reading schedule will run Memorial Day to Labor Day, and we've designed it in such a way that more or less you're going to be reading about 23 psalms a day, or sorry, verses a day. Mm-hmm. 23 verses a day. Very, very manageable. So the idea is that we will spend the summer reading the psalms together, and we will talk about some of the psalms together on the podcast, but we'll use, if we don't do that, then we'll use our thoughts section to talk about what we've been learning in that week's portion of the reading plan. So we hope our audience joins along with us and just dives into the Psalms because it's so rich.
Yeah, absolutely. I cannot wait. I enjoyed this so much, just getting to chat about the Psalms whenever we dug into a specific Psalm and then whenever we just shared our thoughts. I really enjoyed this last year. So I am really looking forward to this year.
100%. Yeah. But while we anticipate that, what is on your mind for today?
Well, you know, I want to talk about what may seem to be a somewhat nebulous concept, and that is the idea of curiosity.
Hmm.
Yeah. Here's why this is on my mind. I hear the concept of curiosity mentioned or referred to 10, 15, maybe 20 times more than I used to maybe 5 years ago. Curiosity has become a highly prized cultural virtue. For me, the signature moment of this is a moment that I think I texted you a video of from the first season of Ted Lasso, which is, you know, 3 or 4 years ago now, where Ted, the main character, who is this sort of slightly bumbling but deeply good-hearted character who wins because he's good-hearted. Mm. And this moment in the show where he talks about the importance of curiosity and how being curious helped him be okay with the fact that people made fun of him and teased him and all that kind of stuff. And it captures what I think is a cultural movement, this movement to embrace curiosity as a value. Have you seen this playing out in your circles?
Well, yes. My circles these days consist of therapists and therapists in training. And curiosity is a hallmark of what a therapist is there to do. I mean, without curiosity, you're not going to really dig into somebody's story very well. You're going to come at it with a posture of, I know, and let me teach you, or let me guide you, or whatever. Curiosity says, let me learn from you. Let me understand you. Let me dive into life from your perspective. And along the way, there's also this perspective of cultural humility to say, I come from this cultural vantage point, but I may be sitting across from somebody who comes from a very different cultural background, whereas that might be a different sexual orientation, gender identity, cultural identity, language, all these differences. And to be curious about where they come from and why or how that has affected them, it permeates everything we talk about. So yes, I have seen this come up quite a bit. I don't know outside of counseling circles if I've seen it a lot. And that's probably because most of my time outside of counseling circles is like 911.
Me and John.
Well, okay. Yeah. You and John, you and I talk about it quite a bit, but you know, 911, it's a different ballgame. We're much more interviewing somebody with real specific goals in mind rather than being super curious. We just have to be really diligent. So anyway, it's a different vibe. So.
Well, and appropriately so, right? Like the last thing, if I'm calling 911, the last thing I really want is the person on the other side of the phone to be like, so how do you feel about that? Right? Like, yeah. No, please get me the help I need and get it now and stop asking stupid questions.
Right. Well, even the good questions they think are still stupid questions, unfortunately. But anyway.
So with that in mind, coming from that place where you've seen this idea of curiosity in play, one of the things I'm always interested in is as a follower of Jesus, I want to be in dialogue with emerging cultural values. I don't want to assume they're right, and I don't want to assume they're wrong. I just want to be aware that they're there, and then I want to have a conversation with them. What is it that this idea of curiosity reveals that perhaps I've been missing in the way that I'm thinking? But also, how does it mesh with a Jesus-informed framework of thinking? What do I need to learn from this cultural value? But what do I need to be careful doesn't seep in accidentally into my thinking? So I always want to have this kind of dialogue, this, I don't know that this is a real word, but a dialogical stance.
So I'll say from my perspective, curiosity... I'm pausing because this is really emotionally impactful, which is not quite what I expected. But honestly, curiosity made seminary possible for me. And so I know I talked a little bit about where curiosity has been in the counseling world, but for me, to adopt a posture of curiosity made seminary so much more rich than it otherwise would have. And I can remember graduating from undergrad with a degree in pastoral ministry and a degree in psychology, and believing, at least from the pastoral ministry's side, that I had a lot of answers and that I knew stuff. And I think there was this need to prove myself or be seen as competent or something like that. And so I don't know that had I gone straight into seminary, that I would have listened and learned and dug in quite so much. And as I got older and as I developed this idea of curiosity, it really put me in the posture of a learner and allowed me to strip away some of the pride that let me assume I knew stuff. And man, my seminary experience was so much more rich for it because I didn't start with the assumption that I knew anything. I started with the assumption that I had a lot to learn and let me find out what's here. Boy, that just changed things.
Well, it's amazing to me that you describe curiosity that way. Just a few weeks ago, I preached at my church, and the text that I was preaching from was the end of the sower and the seed, and the last verse of Jesus' explanation to his disciples about the sower and the seed is, take care how you listen, because to him who has, more will be given, and from him who thinks he has, even what he has will be taken away.
Mm.
And in the context of my sermon, I applied that to humility, but because it was humility in the act of listening, take care how you listen, because I really think you could apply that verse very deeply to curiosity. And I think you just made the point that I think that verse is making, that for the curious person, when they dive into the things of God, they will be given more. For the person who lacks curiosity, even what they have ends up drying up and becoming lifeless.
Mm.
And I really think this is what Jesus was warning his disciples about, to take this sort of posture of a learner, this sort of childlikeness. And it's just intriguing to me. You're making the point I saw in the Bible from your own life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say to that other than I feel the truth of that passage.
Mm.
But you started with kind of the cultural moment where culture is starting to key in on curiosity. And what I'm wondering is, do you see culture valuing curiosity in the same way, or do you think it's slightly different?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I think on the surface, we as a culture, or perhaps I should say certain strands of our culture, are encountering a multitude of different cultures, a multitude of different people who think differently than we do. And from that is a desire not just to value someone who is different, but to recognize that the first step in interacting with someone who is different is to take this posture of a learner, this childlikeness, and say, and to assume I don't know.
Mm.
And I think that is a wonderful gift that multiculturalism gives us. It exposes the fact that we don't know nearly as much as we think we do. And it exposes the fact that a lot of things we take for granted are not simply true, but they are culturally agreed upon decisions about what is true. And that's not the same as biblically true.
Mm.
It's so easy in our limited experience, when most people are living some version of a biblical Christianity, regardless of how accurate or authentic that is, if it gets the stamp of biblical, it's easy to assume a lot. Multiculturalism gives us the gift of dashing those assumptions and calling us to look deeper inside others and therefore look deeper inside ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think there is a consistency there with what Scripture is teaching.
There is. And it's fascinating the way you put all of that, because there were so many different phrases in there that I think are buzzwords in some evangelical circles that smack of relativism. What's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. So there is no objective truth. There's just like how you see the world and how I see the world. And so there were moments where I had that reflex.
And I was saying it.
Right. And then, but then you would say something like, which all of that is different than biblical truth. And then, so then I start swinging the pendulum the other way. And like, there's this staunch, like, what's true is true is true is true. Like, that's just it. We have to stand on truth. We can't be in this vague, wishy-washy, whatever you feel is fine and whatever I feel is fine. No, truth is objective. And so I feel like there's this balancing act that we don't always do well between there is absolute objective truth, full stop. And there are absolute subjective experiences and ways of perceiving the world and norms within various societies that people find to be the right way to live or the normal way to live. And none of those have anything to do with objective truth. They have everything to do with subjective reality. And balancing what fits into what category and how we hold these things into tension is really complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. And even in the category of truth, I think it gets very complicated. You know, one of the illustrations that I've used at times with people is to say, the Bible gives us fixed points about what is true, but those fixed points function like a connect the dots page. The fixed points on the page can often be connected in a wide variety of different ways, and we have to be careful because the dots are what they are, but the way we connect those dots together to make a picture, that's not biblical truth. You know, and this goes really deep. I would say that even the idea of the Trinity is a connecting of the dots.
Sure.
You know, and so we just have to be real, real careful to acknowledge what are the dots and what is the picture we're making from the dots. And then adding all these other layers that you just mentioned, the fact that I have a cultural lens, that there are a host of things that aren't even in the realm of truth. So, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, if you ask a 25-year-old and a 75-year-old what the speed limit is in a particular road, the 25-year-old is going to say, you probably shouldn't go any slower than that. And the 75-year-old is going to say, you probably shouldn't go any faster than that. Right?
Sure. Sure.
I mean, I hate when people go below the speed limit. Like, come on, guys. It's the speed limit. You don't go lower than that. That may not be, and I understand that I am clearly not right there, but there are a lot of things that they're not moral or theological questions per se.
Well, and even when they are, still maintaining a posture of curiosity is so important. Because I think even when Jesus was presented with various moral issues in his time, he often began with a question. Not because I think he was trying to prevaricate or to be irritating or something like that. I genuinely think the question mattered more than him giving an answer. So just taking a posture of humility and a posture of curiosity that says, huh, so it sounds like you have this conviction, or you read the text this way, or you believe this is the right way to live, or whatever it is. Why is that? Where does that come from? What influences you? What? Why? I think those are super good questions.
I totally agree. And I would suggest, on the one hand, a large, large percentage of arguments among people come from a failure of curiosity. It's not an issue of what is true. It's an issue of, do I actually understand what you are saying? And on the other hand, what's interesting to me about curiosity is that I think curiosity takes great energy and effort.
Yes.
The tireder I am, the more quickly I default to my assumptions. And the more clearly I see that my assumptions are obviously right. Right? And I don't mean it that I'm correct about that, but that is the way the world looks to me in that moment.
Oh, absolutely.
And I often have to pause important conversations when I'm in that space of either being physically tired or emotionally tired, because I don't have the energy to be adequately curious. And I know that that's going to short circuit the conversation.
Wow. This has me thinking in a whole new direction. A couple of weeks ago, you posed the idea that nobody should be able to share their opinion publicly unless they have taken that opinion to a close friend who thinks differently than them and fleshed it out a little bit.
Mm. Ooh, I agree with me.
Right?
I would like to encourage all Christians, until let's pick a date at random sometime in November, to really do that.
Why did you pick November?
Because it's when the election is.
Oh, yeah, that. Okay, so
Am I remembering correctly?
You are. I just wasn't thinking along those lines. But here's the interesting thing that your previous comments just made me think of. What if, in addition to fleshing it out with a close friend, maybe you can't share your public opinion or engage in public discourse unless you're well rested?
Mm.
And maybe our societal inability to have productive conversations and to engage well with people we disagree with is that we are chronically stressed, chronically tired, chronically busy, and we don't have the emotional or physical capacity to be curious.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there is a decision-making element in curiosity. It's a commitment, right? I have decided I want to be a curious person.
Mm-hmm.
Then it is a practice issue. I need to learn to pay attention to when I am and am not being curious. And then it is a mental and emotional health issue, which is the kind of piece that you're hitting on that I think is so important. I have to be my best self in order to be curious.
Yeah.
And boy, if we take all of that into account in conversation, we would talk less.
We would talk less, or we would, more of our sentences would end in a question mark and fewer in a period. Mm-hmm. Or an exclamation point.
Yeah, we have had several conversations over the couple of years that we've been doing this about which of us is asking more questions.
And yes,
it has been an effort on both of our sides at certain times to be the one who asks more questions rather than answering questions. And I think it is an intentional effort on both of our sides to cultivate curiosity.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the things I feel the most pressure to develop in myself in preparation for doing therapy, because I think my default settings from childhood are much more on the judgmental snap decision sort of realm. And I think, like I was even talking about in theological discourse, my starting point was always argumentation, defense of why I think I'm right, what I think this theological truth is, or whatever. And that starting point is not where I want to be at all. And I fear that starting point cropping up at some inopportune time, because I think it's counterproductive to therapy, but I also think it's counterproductive to all sorts of things I value. Good discipleship, good parenting, good friendship, good marriage. You can't start with, I'm right and let me show you why.
That's exactly right. Well, and it's fascinating to me, both of us as college students 20 and change years ago would have considered our ability to debate and stand for our theological beliefs a sign of our maturity.
Yes.
And looking back, I would consider my ability and willingness to debate and stand for, in that sense, my beliefs a sign of my immaturity.
Right. Again, not because there's not objective truth.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But because that's just an unhelpful posture.
Well, and because I'm not in my better moments so delusional as to think the reality of objective truth does not guarantee that it's what I'm thinking.
Yes, right.
Like, I have learned the difference in, again, my best moments between truth with a capital T and my opinion of the truth.
Yes, exactly.
And I am interested in being refined.
So just so that I can ask more questions on this episode than you, because it is a contest, not a, anyway. Okay. So I would like to, I'm actually curious, what has helped you along the way in developing a posture of curiosity?
Everything about me wants to say, well, what about you? What has helped you cultivate a thought?
Oh, no, I beat you to it. I win.
Oh, we're nerds.
Competitive ones, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. What has actually helped me? This is such an unfortunate answer, but honestly, I think the thing that has helped me the most is the failure of myself in moments when I was most strident about my opinion.
Oh my gosh, that is my answer as well. Yes, I feel that to be true, but go on.
Yeah, I just, when I have been the most, again, confident isn't even the right word. Strident has a less charitable meaning, I think. And so the moments I have been strident about my opinion, I have hurt people. I have harmed my connection with people. I have become prideful. I have patted myself on the back. I have done more damage than I can honestly capture.
Yes. Like I said, I feel all of those things. And that is honestly the most helpful thing for me too. I would say the number two thing that has helped me is...
Hold on one second.
Yep.
What other things have helped you?
That doesn't count. You can't count that in the question. No, it can't count in the question total. Cool. That's a Pee Wee Herman question. Like, that's I know I am, but what are you? Or something like that. Whatever he said.
No, I would have asked it anyway. I thought you were going to disqualify it on the fact that you were already dating it before I asked the question. But whatever.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Okay, so my number two is the opposite. I have experienced moments where I have chosen a more curious route. And the things that I have learned and the things that I realize I could have said and maybe was tempted to say and how wrong they were or how ill-fitting they would have been to the moment just makes me so glad. Oh, good. I did choose curiosity here, and I learned and grew through the process, and I'm responding to the person in front of me in a much better way than I otherwise would have. Boy, that was a close one. And I feel like it always feels like a close one. Like, it's never like, oh yeah, I'm just a curious person and I ask lots of curious questions and that's that. No, it's always like, oh, thank goodness I remembered to be curious.
Yeah. No, I am, in this topic in particular, I am just a jerk in recovery who knows the right thing to do and doesn't do it. But the number two thing for me that has helped is really this intentional practice of mindfulness. Learning to pay attention to my own thoughts. Learning to watch my thoughts and treat them as thoughts rather than as me. So that there's a little bit of distance and I have the power to say yes or no to them, puts me back in the driver's seat and allows me to choose curiosity or not.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's really important for me.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I would love to turn to the audience and be the one to ask a question. So I would love to know from the audience's perspective, like, what have you learned about curiosity? And actually, I'd love to know, what has it felt like to be asked curious questions from somebody? What was that experience like? Did it feel validating? Did it feel invasive? What was it like when somebody was just genuinely curious?
Yeah. I love that question, actually. How does it make you feel when someone is curious about you? When someone has demonstrated curiosity towards you? That in and of itself is a motivating reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Well, you, Josh from Oregon, what else have you been thinking about? Because frankly, I'm curious.
Okay. So today we are 3 days away from Major League Baseball's opening day. And if I'm being honest about what I'm thinking about, I am not just thinking about the Mariners. I am obsessing over the Mariners. I read every article. I watch every highlight reel. I watch as many games as I possibly can. I know it's spring training and these games don't count for anything, but I'm obsessed. I am watching this team like crazy. And I love what I see. And I can't wait for the season to start. And so because I know this episode's going to come out after the season has started, but we are recording it before it starts. So I'm going to put out my predictions.
Ooh, okay.
So in Major League Baseball, they play 162 games. And typically, if you're going to make the playoffs, you have to win roughly 90 or more games, give or take, depending on the division that you're in. We're in a really tough division, so 90 games probably won't win the division. But I actually think, I'm going to go on record, the Mariners are going to win 94 games this year, and they are going to win the division. That is my prediction, and I'm locking it in on this podcast. And, you know, when our Revelation study comes in and the end times comes out on this podcast, you can look back and say, was Josh from Oregon a prophet or not?
Well, more importantly, I think what you're telling me is that the Mariners winning and the end times are somehow related.
They have never even made it to the World Series. And so I kind of do feel like if the Mariners made it to the World Series, the world would implode somehow.
Oh, yeah. Well, good luck to the Mariners. All of the Mariner players that listen to this podcast, 50% of us are rooting for you.
Oh, ouch.
Well, you don't know which 50%.
Oh, well, I know that I am.
Oh, good point.
Are you even rooting for your Bo Sox? Like, honestly, they're not going to be great this year.
No, they're not. But it's going to be okay. But yes, I will still root for the Red Sox. They weren't great last year. And I still rooted for them. I am not a rabid fan. I am not a glued to the MLB kind of a person. But I do, if I'm going to root for anybody, it's going to be the Red Sox. And I'll catch a couple of games.
Okay. All right. So, you enjoy 5% of the season. I'll enjoy the rest.
Perfect. That's about what I've got.
All right. Well, what are you thinking about since it's not baseball?
No, it's really not. This year, one of my goals is to get a handle on T.S. Eliot's The Four Seasons. The Four Quartets. I always want to call it The Four Seasons. That's a hotel.
I was going to say, isn't that Vivaldi?
Yeah. No, yes, it is Vivaldi. You're right. Four Quartets, which is this masterpiece that Eliot wrote after becoming a Christian. And I just have a quote from The Four Quartets that I think is beautiful, and one of three or four that I wanted to read today, but I'll read this one because I think it's a little relevant to what we were just talking about earlier in the episode. He says, "Do not let me hear of the wisdom of old men, but rather of their folly, their fear of fear and frenzy, their fear of possession, of belonging to another or to others or to God. The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless."
Wow. Man, that's so good.
Isn't that just beautiful? Humility is endless. I have nothing to say about that. I just wanted to read it. So there you go.
It makes me want to find somebody that fits that description and just say, "Can I spend a lot of time with you?"
I know, right?
That's cool.
Absolutely. So good. But all right, now, moving from the profound, as always, to the banal, are you ready for this week's Which Josh question?
Oh, man. I'm so, so excited. Go for it.
All right. Well, this week's Which Josh question is, which Josh was once sneezed upon whilst he slept.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this is me, Josh from Oregon. This is a family story if ever there was one. My daughter did not tell me. So my daughter sneezed on me. Okay, so that's I'm going to let the cat out of the bag early. She didn't.
So she's the sneezer and you're the sneezy.
I'm sneezy. So she did not tell me this until she was probably like 13. But when she was 4, she walked over and she was tasked with waking me up from a nap or something like that. Or maybe I was sleeping nights and it was time to be like woken up and come down for dinner or something. And so it was her job to come and wake me up. And she got right up to me and she was about to wake me up and she sneezed. And the snot went in my hair. And she freaked out and she just ran away and she never woke me up and she never told me what she did. She just left.
Oh, so you spent that whole day with extra gel in your hair.
I don't even put gel in my hair. So
some gel in your hair.
Yeah. Oh, so it just grosses me out to think that that happened. Like, is that a day that I took a shower? Like, I don't know what happened. I don't know. So anyway. And my daughter loves to tell that story. She just thinks it's hilarious.
Man, and to think that's the girl that is currently in India serving orphans and loving Jesus.
Yeah.
It's better. Been a long road.
Yes, it has. So, yep, that's what I got.
Oh, that makes my skin crawl.
Yes. Yes. But... well, shall we chat again next week?
Absolutely. I can't wait.
All right. I'll talk to you then.
All right. Talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.